Okay, so you know how in law school they like really drill it into you? That whole thing about needing a written contract, like a formal contract for real estate to make it like legally binding. It's practically law school 101,
Oh,
right?
yeah, definitely. Statute of frauds, big time.
But what if I told you, just imagine this, that a simple document, something you'd file in a regular divorce case, could actually be enough to be that legally binding proof? It's kind of wild when you think about it. And that's exactly what we're going to unpack today in this deep dive. We're looking at Timberlake v. Heflin, this case out of West Virginia. And let me tell you, it really throws a wrench into how we usually think about property law.
You got it. That's exactly what makes this case so interesting, all the unexpected twists and turns. But to fully understand, like really grasp what happened and why it was so surprising, you got to start with a solid foundation. You got to know the statute of frauds inside and out.
I like how it usually works.
Right. So in West Virginia, it's like a lot of other places. They have this law. It's specifically West Virginia Code 36-1-3. And that's the one that basically says, hey, if you're going to agree to sell land, you got to put it in writing. If you want a court to actually enforce it, that is.
Makes sense. To make it official.
Exactly. And it's there for a reason, a really important reason. Think about it. This is serious stuff, buying and selling property. So this law, the statute of frauds, it's basically a huge safeguard, right? It's there to stop people from coming in with fake claims, saying, oh yeah, we had a deal, when they didn't. Plus, even without any bad intentions, you can have honest misunderstandings about such a big transaction. And that can get really messy.
Yeah, imagine trying to sort that out in court just based on people's memories and he said, she said, nightmare.
Exactly. And that's where the law steps in and says, nope, you got to put it in writing. Something solid, something we can point to. It's like the basic protection you learn about from day one, almost like a universal truth in real estate law.
Exactly. So you'd naturally assume that a casual oral agreement, like something that comes up during divorce, oh yeah, you get the house. Ooh, you'd think that wouldn't be worth much, legally speaking, especially with the statute of frauds looming over
Right,
everything.
like a handshake deal for a house. Forget about it.
Exactly. But here comes Timberlake v. Heflin, and it throws us a curveball. This case shows us a situation where that basic understanding that you need a written contract for a real estate deal, it just doesn't hold up.
Totally.
So that's what we're doing today, unraveling this legal mystery. How did a spoken agreement about a house, something that came up during a divorce, actually end up being enforced in court, even with the statute of frauds? What was it about this case that made it so different?
It's all about the evidence. That's what we're diving into. So first things first, we got to lay out the basics, get everyone on the same page. Richard Timberlake and Sherry Heflin, they were the owners of their home in West Virginia, right? Married couple, owned their home together.
Seems straightforward enough so far.
But here's a detail that's super important. They held the property as joint tenants with the right of survivorship. And that right there, that phrase, that's where a lot of the legal action hinges.
Okay, time for a quick law school refresher. For our listeners who maybe haven't encountered that term in a while, break it down for us. What does joint tenants with the right of survivorship actually mean? And why is it such a big deal in this case?
Sure. So basically, joint tenancy with that special right of survivorship, it means both people, both owners, have equal shares in the property. 50-50, your partners. But the real kicker is, what happens if one of them passes away? If that happens, their ownership automatically goes to the surviving owner. Like a built-in transfer, no court battles, no probate court, nothing like that. Just boom, you're the sole owner.
Interesting. So built-in inheritance, essentially.
Exactly. Automatic. But in this case, things get complicated because, well, life happens, circumstances change.
And in this case, the big change was divorce.
Yep, exactly.
So they start going through the whole divorce process, the discussions, the negotiations, and somewhere along the line, they allegedly make an oral agreement about the house.
Right, no formal contract, just talking it out, trying to figure things out.
According to what we found, the agreement was basically this. Mr. Timberlake gets some specific personal property things, like a vehicle, a motorcycle, and in exchange, Mrs. Heflin agreed to transfer her ownership in the house to him. Essentially a trade-off.
A verbal agreement, no paperwork. And you know where this is going,
Oh
right?
yeah, this is where things start to get messy. So Miss Heflin, she goes ahead and files for divorce, officially. Makes sense. But here's the turn, the part that really throws a wrench into everything. Inside her divorce complaint, the actual legal document she files with the court, she includes this sworn statement, an affidavit.
And remember, this isn't just a casual statement. It's a formal declaration made under oath.
Big difference. Huge.
And in this affidavit, she clearly states in writing that she's agreed to give her part of the house to Mr. Timberlake. Done deal, according to her. And that right there is the little detail that this whole case is going to come down to.
It's almost like a confession.
Yeah.
Or a legally binding promise just tucked away in this divorce filing. But before we jump ahead, there's another twist to add to the mix. The divorce itself is finalized. The marriage is officially over. But get this, the final decree doesn't actually mention the house at all. It's completely silent on the whole issue of the marital home.
Yeah, that's where it gets a little tricky. They sorted out some other stuff, divided up some of their belongings. But the house, nope, not a word. And that happens sometimes in divorces. It's called bifurcation. Basically, the court can finalize the divorce itself, like dissolving the marriage first, and then deal with all the messy property division later in a separate proceeding.
Makes sense. I guess it can get pretty complicated when you're talking about dividing up assets, especially real estate. So the court might want to separate those things out just to make things a bit more manageable. But so where does that leave Mr. Timberlake? He's thinking they had a deal, right? And he'd already given up his share of the personal property based on that agreement.
Exactly. And he's thinking, hey, wait a minute, where's my house? He's done his part. So he decides to go to court, files a lawsuit. Basically, he's asking the court to force Ms. Heflin to follow through with what they agreed on, make her officially transfer the property to him. Legally speaking, that's called specific performance.
Make her stick to the deal. But that must have been a tough sell, right? Especially because, you know, there wasn't that formal written contract.
Oh, yeah. So he runs headfirst into this legal brick wall called the Statute of Frauds. Because remember, there's no written contract specifically for the house. And the trial court, they basically say, nope, case dismissed. They went right back to that fundamental principle, oral agreements for real estate, they're just not enforceable. End of story.
Seems like a pretty open and shut case at that point. Oral promise, no written contract, statute of frauds wins. But this is where Timberlake v. Heflin takes this crazy turn, right?
You got it. Because Mr. Timberlake, he appeals a decision. And that's when the West Virginia Supreme Court steps in and they completely change the game. They actually reverse the trial court's decision.
And that's the heart of this deep dive. This is what we're here to unpack. How did the Supreme Court find a way around this seemingly ironclad rule, the statute of frauds? What was their logic?
It's all about how they interpreted the law. The key here is that the statute of frauds, it doesn't necessarily need a super formal contract, something with a big title. Real estate contract, signed, sealed, delivered, the whole nine yards. What it does require is some note or memorandum, something in writing that clearly shows there was an agreement, enough to be like, yep, they agreed to this.
It's like a paper trail, basically. Something solid the court can point to and say, okay, there's proof.
Exactly. So the big question that the Supreme Court had to wrestle with was, could that sworn statement, that affidavit Mrs. Heflin filed as part of her divorce complaint, could that count as the memorandum that the statute of frauds talks about? Was it enough?
So they're basically saying that even though it wasn't a traditional real estate contract, that affidavit, that sworn statement, could potentially be the loophole, the exception to the rule. Fascinating.
Totally. And the West Virginia Supreme Court, they said, yes, it can. In their eyes, that affidavit, it had all the essential pieces to meet the requirements of the statute of frauds. Think of it this way. The statute of frauds is like this gatekeeper. It's there to protect against those shady deals, to make sure there's real, solid proof of an agreement. But in this case, that affidavit, it basically became the key to unlock that gate.
That's a great way to think about it, the affidavit as the key. But what was it about this specific affidavit that made it so compelling? It couldn't have been just any casual mention of the house, right? What were the details that the court really zeroed in on?
You're right. It had to be specific. So the court, they pointed out a few key things. First, the affidavit was signed by the person who would be responsible for transferring the property. In this case, it was Mrs. Heflin. She was the one making the promise.
So her signature was crucial, like taking ownership of that statement.
Absolutely. Second, the affidavit actually described the property. They didn't need like the super technical legal description, but it clearly said their jointly owned marital home.
Mm.
And the court said, okay, that's clear enough. We know what property they're talking about.
So it identified the specific house even without all the legal jargon.
Right. And the third thing, the affidavit spelled out the core of the agreement. Mrs. Heflin's clear intention to transfer her share of the house to Mr. Timberlake. No beating around the bush. It just stated it outright. Those three things together, that's what made it so strong in the court's eyes.
signed, specific about the property, and clearly stating the intent to transfer ownership. It makes sense that the court would latch onto those details. But this wasn't just the court inventing a whole new legal theory out of thin air, right? Our research pointed out that they were actually drawing on some existing case law.
Yeah, definitely. They weren't just making stuff up as they went along. The Supreme Court, they specifically cited a couple of earlier cases, also from West Virginia, Connell v. Connell and Turney v. Marmion. These cases, they'd already established this idea that legal documents filed in court, things like complaints and especially sworn statements like affidavits, they could be enough to meet that written proof requirement of the statute of frauds.
Interesting. So basically, the court was saying, look, we've seen this before. This isn't totally new territory. But I'm guessing the fact that this statement was made under oath, that probably added a lot of weight to it, right? Made it even more official.
Oh, absolutely. It's a big deal to make a statement under oath. The court takes that seriously. So the fact that Mrs. Heflin signed this document, swore it was true, and then filed it in court as part of the legal proceeding, well, it basically gave that statement extra oomph. More credibility.
Makes sense. It wasn't just some casual conversation. It was a formal declaration. But there's one more legal concept that we should probably unpack here because it keeps popping up in our research and it sounds pretty complicated. And that's equitable conversion?
Yeah, that one can be a bit of a head scratcher. But it's actually pretty straightforward once you break it down.
I'm all ears.
So imagine this. Richard and Sherry, they have their agreement about the house, right? Even though it was just spoken, it was a real agreement. And they both intended to follow through. So what equitable conversion does is it basically says that from that moment on, the law starts to see things a little differently. In the eyes of the law, Mr. Timberlake, the buyer, he's already the equitable owner, even though the official paperwork hasn't caught up yet.
Interesting. So like a legal fiction, almost. Even though the deed hasn't been transferred, the law is basically saying, we recognize that he's the intended owner, even if the paperwork is lagging behind.
Exactly. It's all about fairness. Miss Heflin, she still has the official title, but she's kind of like holding it in trust for Mr. Timberlake until they could do the formal transfer.
Because it would be really unfair if, after they made the agreement, she could just say, nope, change my mind, and keep the house. Especially after he'd already given up his share of the other stuff.
Exactly. And that idea of fairness, it really ties into another big piece of this case. The fact that Mr. Timberlake had already held up his end of the bargain. He'd given up his claim to that personal property, like the car and the motorcycle. He trusted that she would follow through with her side of the deal.
So if the court had said, tough luck, no written contract, it would have been like rewarding her for going back on her word. And not just that, it would have given her a double win she'd get to keep her share of the house and all the stuff that he'd already transferred to her.
Right. And that would be a classic case of unjust enrichment. One person getting way more than their fair share, unfairly benefiting at the expense of the other, and the courts, they try to avoid that whenever possible. In fact, the West Virginia Supreme Court, they actually said a constructive trust is substantially an appropriate remedy against unjust enrichment.
So basically, they were saying, we're not going to let her get away with this. They use the concept of a constructive trust to basically say, even though on paper she's still the owner, we're going to treat it as if she's holding the property for him because that's the fair thing to do.
Exactly. So wait for the court to step in and fix a situation that's just fundamentally wrong.
Powerful stuff. But there's one more twist to the story, something we should probably mention. Sadly, Mr. Timberlake passed away while all this was still playing out in court.
Yeah.
But the court decided that his heirs, the people who inherited his estate, they could still step in and continue the lawsuit.
Which is interesting, right? Because usually with that joint tenancy and right of survivorship, when one owner dies, the other one automatically gets their share. No questions asked.
Exactly. That's the whole point of it. But here the court said, no, hold on. There was a valid agreement and we're going to enforce it.
Right. They basically said that oral agreement, backed up by that affidavit, it overrode those typical rules of joint ownership. Pretty powerful stuff.
So much to unpack here. But if our listeners walk away from this deep dive with one key takeaway, what should it be? What's the big lesson here? Especially for those who are thinking about going into family law.
Oh, if you're going to be a divorce lawyer, this case should be flashing neon signs in your head.
Mm-hmm.
Document everything, and I mean everything. Any agreement about property, who gets what, get it in writing and file it with the court.
Even if the clients are totally on the same page, they're best friends, they're saying, oh, we trust each other completely.
Nope. Doesn't matter. Get it in writing. File it officially. Because as this case shows, things can change, people can change their minds, and then you're stuck trying to untangle a mess years down the road. Trust me, it's better to be safe than sorry.
A little extra paperwork on the front end can save everyone a lot of heartache and legal battles later on. But stepping back from the specifics of divorce law, this case also teaches us something really important about the statute of frauds itself, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It shows us that the statute of frauds, this big, scary rule that seems so absolute, it's not always a deal breaker. It's not like every single oral agreement about real estate is automatically void, thrown out the window. It's more nuanced than that.
More wiggle room than you might expect.
Exactly. If there's enough evidence, something solid in writing that proves there was an agreement, then that oral agreement can still be valid, even with the statute of frauds. And what's so fascinating about Timberlake v. Heflin is that the proof, the evidence, it came from this unexpected source, that affidavit tucked away in a divorce filing.
Yeah, a document that you wouldn't normally think of as a real estate contract, but that's exactly what it became.
Exactly. And the case really highlights how the law tries to balance things out. On the one hand, you've got these formal rules, like the statute of frauds, that are designed to prevent fraud and keep things clear. But on the other hand, the courts also want to be fair. They want to make sure that people can't just weasel out of their agreements and take advantage of others.
So it's like this constant push and pull between following the rules and making sure that things are just. And in this case, the court used this concept of a memorandum, something in writing that shows an agreement, to bridge that gap.
Exactly. And our sources had this great way of putting it. They said, the statute of frauds is like this gatekeeper standing guard demanding written proof. But in this case, that affidavit, it became the unexpected key that unlocked the gate, letting that oral agreement through.
Love that analogy, the key to the gate. But let's play devil's advocate for a second. What if that affidavit had been different? What if it was more vague, less specific? Like, what if Ms. Heflin had just said something like, oh, we'll figure out the house situation later?
And that's a good question. And the answer is probably not. It wouldn't have been enough. The statute of frauds, it wants details. It needs that writing to be pretty specific about what property is being talked about.
Yeah.
A vague statement like, we'll figure it out later, that's not going to fly.
Too wishy-washy.
Exactly. But in Timberlake v. Heflin, they were talking about their jointly owned marital home. And that was enough for the court to go, okay, we know what they're referring to. This is the specific property.
Yeah.
Even if they didn't have the full address or the legal property description, they could figure it out based on the context.
So specificity matters. The details matter. And this whole discussion about joint tenancy with right of survivorship, that was so important in this case for a really specific reason, wasn't it? Oh, for sure. Because without that enforceable agreement, without that affidavit, things would have gone very differently. Remember, when one joint tenant dies, their share automatically goes to the other one. It's like built-in inheritance.
So if there hadn't been that agreement in place, that affidavit, Ms. Heflin, would have gotten the entire house just because she outlived Mr. Timberlake.
Right, but the court said, nope, there was an agreement and it's going to be honored. It's like the agreement trumped those normal rules of joint ownership. Pretty remarkable when you think about it. A powerful reminder that sometimes those informal agreements, especially in something like a divorce, they can have huge implications even after someone passes away. But it's important to clarify that this case, it's not like it created some brand new exception to the statute of frauds. It wasn't a revolution.
Right.
What it did was it showed us how existing rules, specifically those rules about what counts as written proof of an agreement, those can be applied in new and surprising ways, especially in family law, where things can get pretty complicated.
Exactly. And it's a good reminder that the law is always evolving, always adapting to new situations. And as future lawyers, you guys got to be ready for that. You got to be able to see those connections, to see how those old rules can apply in these new complex scenarios.
So the big takeaway here is even those documents that seem kind of basic, routine, like a divorce affidavit, they can have a huge impact, especially in property law.
Absolutely.
And for our listeners, for anyone who's interested in diving deeper into these legal gray areas, Timberlake v. Heflin is definitely worth checking out. But beyond that, this case really gets you thinking, doesn't it? Like, imagine how all the digital communication we do these days, emails, text messages, even stuff we post online, imagine how all that might play into the statute of frauds in the future.
Right. That's a whole other area where things could get really interesting.
Could a text message chain about selling a house be enough to meet that written proof requirement? Could a voice memo? I mean, who knows? But these are the kinds of questions that courts are going to be grappling with as technology keeps evolving.
Oh, definitely. It's like a whole new frontier for the law.
It is. And it all comes back to that balance between upholding these formal rules, like the statute of frauds, and making sure that justice is done, that people are held accountable for their agreements. And that's a debate that's never going to go away. It's one you'll all be a part of as you move into your legal careers.
That's what makes the law so fascinating, right? There's always something new to consider.
Exactly. Always a new angle, a new wrinkle. So as you guys move on from law school and start practicing, remember, even those everyday documents, those filings that seem routine, they can hold the key to really big legal outcomes. And as Timberlake v. Heflin shows us, sometimes the answers are hiding in the most unexpected places.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Thanks for joining me on this deep dive. Until next time.
Yeah.